Hello, everybody, and welcome into the Apples and Genos Fantasy Hockey Podcast. My name is Nate Grootnibbelink, and I will be your host. Today, I'm continuing my strategy series where I bring up a bunch of topics related to fantasy hockey strategy and then make somebody else talk about them. The aim here is that we all get better together and are able to gather strategy tips and tricks from all the sharpest minds out there. For this show, I'm excited to welcome Victor Nuno to the podcast. Victor is the host of the Fantasy Hockey Life podcast, which is a terrific podcast with a dynasty bent. Victor, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, Nate. Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be on the show.
Yeah, I was pretty pumped to have you. I've been having some requests for some dynasty content on the podcast, so happy that we were able to make this work. So why don't you get us started here? Just tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, maybe include something that people who know you from the podcast might not know about you.
Yeah, so I've been really, when I grew up, my dad was in love with sports, but to my dad, sports meant soccer. So I never really got into hockey until I was like in high school, when kind of the Sharks were really were starting, and they kind of had a couple of those surprising playoff wins. Kind of get into hockey then, but to the thing about some people might not know about me, I'm actually a practicing physician and a professor. So kind of went dark for a long time while I went through all my training and just kind of focused on that. Mm-hmm. And then when I kind of emerged on the other side, I got kind of back into hockey as I was able to have some free time to, you know, have the hobby a little bit more, and got into playing fantasy in was sometime around 2013 or 14. The first league I joined was a dynasty league. So kind of went off the deep end, I think. It wasn't like a casual redraft league. It was not the deepest of deep leagues, but it was it definitely was not like your redraft leagues that, you know, you can just drop certain players and not worry about it. So I think it kind of suited me though, because I've always been someone that can like appreciate the reward of waiting a long time for something and the delayed gratification. So that's something that I really like about the dynasty play and kind of the deeper league. So it was actually kind of a good thing, even though it's probably not the recommended place to start for a lot of fantasy players. It's kind of hard. And a lot of podcasts, as you mentioned, don't really cater to that. I remember early on listening to Keepin Carlson, who we're all buds with. And I just remember thinking they would talk about drop this guy, drop that. And I'd be like, well, I can't drop this guy. Like, there's no one remarkably decent on the waiver wire. But obviously you're talking about different leagues there, you know. So, and that's kind of why we started, Fantasy Hockey Life is more for that deeper dynasty league that Jesse and I really like to cater to. And I play all kinds, but I really enjoy the dynasty leagues the most.
Yeah. All right. Well, how about you tell us who your favorite NHL team is, and maybe you can sell me on why I should abandon the Leafs and cheer for them instead.
Yeah. Well, I don't know that I'll be able to do that, but I'm a Sharks fan, primarily geographically, but I also, I think I appreciate what the organization is going through. I mean, they have gone through some interesting times, and they were so good for so long, and now they're kind of struggling a little bit. For the most part, I like how they deal with, you know, situations. Obviously, they had the Evander Kane thing, and I feel like they've done a decent job with that, although some may argue, but they usually don't make really awful decisions as an organization. So I kind of like that about them. Mm-hmm. But I also, one reason you might want to consider is whether they play good or bad. No one around here really cares. So that's kind of a good thing, right? Like,
yeah, it's a little different from Toronto.
Yeah. Like, you could have a good game, or things could be going pretty well, and there's still tons of criticism and, to be had. And so that is really the case right here. You will find obviously some passionate fans, but for the most part, like walking around the city, people wear Sharks gear and like, hey, go Sharks, but like don't really know as deeply as I would think most people understand hockey and follow the game.
Yeah, it's a different animal up here, that's for sure. Everybody's complaining about who's playing on the fourth line today, so
Yeah, I don't think the Sharks can could even most casual fans couldn't name your bottom six players.
Yeah. Well, why don't we get into our topics for today? We're going to be focused right in on Dynasty for today. Yeah, definitely had some requests for this come up in my Discord channel. And I'm really happy that we're able to dig into some of these for the listeners today. So let's start a little bit basic. Do you prefer cat leagues, like categories, or points leagues for Dynasty? And why would you choose one versus the other?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think that in some ways, it's almost like one isn't really better than the other. It's kind of just a preference. I enjoy playing in both. But if I had to choose and only play in one, it would be points. Mm-hmm. And the reason I like points leagues is because, well, it can reward a lot of different scenarios. And with obviously with different point values, part of the trouble with categories is, especially with certain things like game-winning goals and shutouts, mm-hmm. basically events that are more random power play goals. Not that those aren't fun to cheer for and fun to have as a category, but they're just really random and not really reproducible. And I guess some people play fantasy because of the random win factor, but I play to win, and it's hard to win when things are random and not predictable. So I don't really enjoy that. I would rather reward a power play goal, a shorthanded goal, a shutout with a certain point value. So when it happens, you get rewarded, but there isn't a separate category that can completely sway a matchup when there's a random thing that happens. That I remember one of the leagues I was in had shorthanded points as a category, shutouts as a category. There was another thing I can't remember, but there were basically three categories that were completely random, and someone could get one of those things and win the category. And it was usually zero or one in that category for both teams all week. And that's just crazy. Like that sways the matchup way too much. And I like points for that reason, that you can have players, I guess some people don't like this, but you can have someone like, you know, a Mikko Rantanen be as valuable as like a JT Miller who hits a lot and right. You know, shoots and blocks and stuff. So I kind of like being able to say, well, they're sort of equal value for these guys, because if you really overvalue certain things like in categories leagues, you have basically this skewed population of players that are basically way more valuable than anyone else. And if you don't have one or two of those, you can't compete. Yeah. And I find that's just really difficult. I think for a lot of reasons, points leagues, they kind of even the playing field a little bit. There's still certainly ways to skew them in your favor. And I also don't like in categories leagues, I mean, this is a strategy, but it also is frustrating to me that, everything is worth the same. So a goal is worth the same as a block right. or a hit, whatever the category is. So you can basically just punt certain categories. And I did this in one league where I was able to take down a team that had, all the best scorers. And my team was kind of evolving, didn't have those guys. And I just stacked all the peripheral categories and eked out a win. And reality, like, that shouldn't happen, right? Like, the better team with the score should probably win that matchup, 99% of the time. So I like both, but I tend to favor the points leagues just because of those reasons. Unless the category leagues, there are ways, certainly like in Fantrax, where you can combine goalie points, so shutouts can be rewarded, but they're not like their own categories. You can also combine things like hits, blocks, and PIMs. So there are ways, I think, to make the and to equate like rate stats in there so that it's not all just counting. So I think having a blend of rate and counting stats makes categories leagues much more interesting and a little bit more fair. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good stuff there. Now, another aspect that a lot of people bring into Dynasty specifically is a salary cap. So they use whatever the NHL salary cap is, or they construct an artificial cap based on the size of the league and how many teams and how many players. Do you like playing in salary cap? Do you normally choose not to play with a salary cap? I'm curious as to your thoughts on salary cap leagues or avoiding them in general.
No, I don't avoid them. I I quite like them, actually. I think it's fun. It's a different challenge for sure. Mm-hmm. It's when you play in salary cap leagues, I really like it because it basically just boils down to value per dollar. It's right. You know, people like Panarin, you know, Erik Karlsson, even though he's kind of past his prime, players that, you know, Drew Doughty, that could have pretty decent value, you know, they sit on the waiver wire often. Yep. Because the value, or at least they should in most leagues, the value per dollar is just not there. It really is all about getting like your Zibanejads and, you know, guys on entry-level contracts that are contributing a lot. And, you know, value like guys like McKinnon and Crosby, you know, right mm-hmm. now before McKinnon gets paid, are really, really valuable. And so I really like that. And also the not big name players, right, that they really just give you so much value for what they're worth. And you can just break it down into an equation there of just like whose value is the most. And I like it because a couple of leagues that I'm in, we try to mimic as close as possible to what the NHL might do. And, okay. you know, having to have buyouts and not just like drop people whenever you right. want, you have to buy them out. And I think that there's a whole lot more that you have to think about with that. And it makes the moves that you make more meaningful, more impactful. You have to sort of think about it and plan ahead. You can't have all your players on big contracts. You have to have a blend of entry level contracts, you know, medium mm-hmm. like bridge deals and longer term contracts, which is basically what successful NHL teams do. And I really like that challenge. And I think that even if you don't want to play in a cap league, you have to understand the cap, right? Like I think Sergei yeah. Bobrovsky and Spencer Knight is a yeah. perfect example of that this year. Regardless of what you may think, and we may all think of what Bob has done in the last few years, the fact of the matter is his contract dictated that he was going to get tons of opportunity this year, yeah. whether he was good or not. And he, you know, he's been decent. So you have to be able to look at that. And playing in a cap league just, you know, amplifies that and makes you so much more aware of all those situations. And even if you, you know, even if you're in, like in my cap leagues influence my other leagues, I'm like, oh, okay, this player is getting an opportunity because of this situation and this cap circumstance. So it right. gives you more insight as to what's going on as opposed to just, you know, leagues that ignore that.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I like about Dynasty in general is how it, brings players to your attention that you might not have thought about if you were only playing in redraft leagues. So you might have kind of an inside track when they start to produce at a, you know, like a 10 or 12 team redraft league level, where you're thinking about consistently rostering them. And definitely I can see that kind of logic applying to salary cap as well, where you have to think about, okay, now this guy just got a big contract. That probably means he's being paid to be on the top line, be on the top power play, those kinds of things. So I like that.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Why don't we dig into some questions about a startup? So if someone's going into a startup, maybe they've never played Dynasty before, but we want to give some sort of base, how you personally go about your startups. Do you like to go young, you know, draft a bunch of guys, maybe 25 or younger for an arbitrary cutoff? Or do you like to buy older elite guys who are kind of cheaper because everybody thinks, oh, that guy's 30, doesn't have many years left anyway, and just kind of make that kind of first 2 years all in push for the title? Do you have a preferred strategy that way, or is it more fluid than that? How do you go about it?
Yeah, I think it's a little more fluid. It kind of depends on the situation, the draft position, the league. We actually started a couple of leagues during the pandemic with some friends we met on Keeping Karlsson, and we did two leagues. They're kind of like sister leagues. One of them has 20, one of them has, I think, 12 or 14. And I thought it would be fun to employ opposite strategies with those leagues. Mm-hmm. And they're both categories, salary cap leagues. So mm-hmm. in the deeper league, I saw everybody angling to win now, which is generally what I would prefer to do. But there were four or five teams that were clearly just going for older vets that are producing now and trying to win right mm-hmm. away. And I just decided that I was going to zag while everyone else zigged and went all young. And it was sort of based on the context of, you know, the other teams and what was available to me. We also allowed trades to happen before the draft. And so a couple of teams just decided to sell away all their prospect picks and get, you know, pro picks instead. And I was on the buying end of that, and I was able to acquire, I can't even remember now, like 5 or 6 first round picks. And okay. So I was able to get, you know, like Kirby Dach and Cole Caulfield, Jack Hughes, Quentin Byfield, Marco Rossi, nice. Basically just a super stack, Lucas Raymond, Ryan Merkley, a bunch of young studs on that team, Spencer Knight, Doug Stahl. So I felt like in that situation, it was good to kind of just go young and get some good. I got a first round pick in the first year, got William Eklund. I'm sure I'll get a first round pick this year, get one of the top players. And then when all my guys come of age, it'll be pretty hard to beat me. And I was okay. Since I'm the commissioner of the league, I was okay, you know, putting that off for a little bit because I knew that the league was going to stick around. I mean, that's part of the concern there is that, well, the league's going to go away. Well, not if I'm the commissioner. It's not. It's right. And then as a fun exercise, I thought in the other league, you know, I'm going to go all in right now. And I actually did the opposite and traded some of my prospect picks for top players now. And you know, in that league, I was able to get a bunch of really, you know, win now players. And I was actually able to package some of my younger players for even more stars in that league. Okay. So, you know, I was able to get retained salary on some guys, you know, like Taves, which didn't work out so well, but at least he's only costing me $5 million. Kopitar is only costing me $5 million.
Okay.
Bergeron, McKinnon, McCarr, Petrie, guys like that, Horvat, face-off wins count in this league.
Okay.
Yep. So I was able to kind of, you know, go that way and kind of sell off those assets. So I think it's a fun exercise to try both in general, I would say, especially if you don't know the longevity of the league, you probably just want to try to win right away, you know, because who knows? I was actually also in a league with some people I didn't know that well a couple of years ago. And I did that strategy of let's just win now. I won the first year and the league disbanded after that. So it's like, okay,
there you go.
Yeah, that was a good decision. So when you don't know people that well, you're not sure how well the league is going to continue or if it will. I think it's not a good idea if you're not sure to try to, you know, win later, because who knows if there will be a later. But if you're pretty confident it'll continue. There's another league too that we started like 4 years ago where I did the hybrid strategy, which is always kind of tricky. Is, you know, where you're kind of like have a mixture. So I had like my first round pick was Burns, and then second round pick was Vasilevsky, and then it was kind of like a mixture of like older, younger, and some, you know, decent prospects. And my goal was to win in 3 years, and that's what happened. We was able to win last season. So that's harder because that hybrid, you know, generally if you do it wrong, you basically just end up a middling team and you never get over the top. But when I saw us, I have a co-manager, Ben Burnett, who people know from Short Shifts. When we saw that we were doing pretty well in that league, I decided to sell off my shiny toys of prospects for some win now pieces. And that was a good decision because we ended up pulling it off in the end. But that's always tricky. Like, you kind of have to do that. You're not probably just going to win based on your draft strategy. You're going to have to pull some moves.
Right.
And luckily I was able to acquire some good later round prospects. Like Hoglander was one that kind of stood out, and Mo Sider was a pick early on that has turned out to be amazing. So things like that, you obviously have to do all of those things well. It's not just like the draft strategy. There's a lot more to it than that.
Right. Yeah. And I just want to clarify, just in case there's anyone listening who's not as into Dynasty as you or I might be. What a lot of people do when they do a startup draft is they'll separate kind of veterans from rookies. Usually there's a games played cutoff that's instituted, like 100 games played in the NHL. Everybody with 100 or less games played in the NHL gets put into one draft, and everybody above that gets put into another draft. And oftentimes you can trade picks between the two drafts and kind of build your strategy, as Victor was talking about, around that.
Actually, one more thing on that.
Yeah.
If I would say that if you're planning on running this, I'm not necessarily sure I recommend that, because it was a gigantic headache to track all of that. So as the person who tracked all that, it was not fun. I basically had to create this gigantic spreadsheet that tracked everybody's picks. And we had something like, I can't even remember, 500 and something total picks.
Right.
So there were a lot, and people were just trading picks nonstop and like keeping track of this pick started with this person and then went to here and to here and to here. And it was like, yeah, who ended up with that pick? It was very difficult. So it's fun and it's awesome, especially if you're not the one that has to keep track of it.
Yeah, that's fair. All right. Now, do you have specific positions that you like to target, maybe earlier in the draft or more often? Are you trying to go a little more balanced? Is it literally just about who's there on the board at any given time? Does position, I guess, kind of factor into your thinking a whole lot when you're in a startup draft?
Yeah, it does, for sure. I'm definitely of the opinion that I would never take a goalie early. It's funny, you and I have talked about this. I've pretty much practiced the zero G strategy for the last half decade, even though
right,
it didn't have a name. But Jesse and I, we would always talk about we'd be big old goalie faders. Fade. For all the reasons you've articulated. So definitely, I'm never going to reach on a goalie, except that one time, a couple of times, I have, like early on when Vasilevskiy was even younger, there were a couple instances where I reached for him somewhat early in startup draft, just because in those leagues, the value of I think it really depends. You have to know the strategy. You have to know the point system or the scoring system of your league.
Sure.
There are certainly leagues where a volume stud starter is just absolutely, you know, way above what anyone else can earn, right, points wise. So in those situations, in a really deep league with high value for stud goalies, it can be decent strategy. But in general, I avoid that. I just don't think it's generally worth it. And there's often times where you can, as you've mentioned, make up a lot of value there. So mm-hmm, I tend to avoid goalies. We're in a league together, the Fantasy Hockey Life Dynasty. And in that league, we have bonus points for defensive and scoring.
Yep.
And so in a league like that, someone like Cale Makar is really valuable. And in the drafts that we did for that league, I took him as my first round pick because, you know, I usually do a calculation of value over replacement and looking at all the players and who's most valuable and what kind of tier they're in and all those kinds of things. So I usually break it all down very specifically that way and see, you know, where everyone fits. And I, when I did that, it was very clear to me that Cale Makar was going to be an absolute beast. And when you look at our scoring system right now, he is right now fifth in scoring points per game.
Yeah.
And that's about where I took him. I think I took him sixth overall or something.
Yeah,
like
I think
that.
So. Yeah.
So, you know, you have to, you have to kind of think about it that way. So I certainly could have taken, I would have taken a forward, a winger probably. Centers, I tend to fade a little bit, unless you're getting McDavid or, you know, Dreisaitl or,
right,
or McKinnon. There's so much value at center, I tend to fade those. So wingers, particularly right wingers, tends to be a position that I find, if you're not at the top elite few, it can be hard to find good value for those. So I tend to look at it that way. If you have positions like that and it's not just forward, then you certainly want to think about that. Like, and also how many slots you have. I mean, I've been in leagues where you just have like two like two center, two left wing, two right wing, and 4D, and no skater spot. Right. If you're in a league like that, you have to be really careful about which players you pick, because the value over replacement is immense in a roster like that. But if you're talking about, you know, if you have more like 12 or 14 active spots, then it completely changes the picture, right? Because now you're just looking at value over the placement of the waiver wire and how much depth you can get. So in those leagues, it's all about, you pretty much win with the middle of your roster, middle to bottom of your roster, not with the top of your roster. So in those leagues, it's just all about great depth in general. So you have to think about it that way. And you might also, in leagues like that, I've done the strategy where you might trade, not an early pick, but like maybe a fifth rounder for like a seventh and eighth rounder, because oftentimes that middle value can be more than what you would get from that, you know, sort of middle to early round pick. So, you know, those are things to think about. I think you just have to, I'm always trying to just look at, okay, who's available and what is the value of the pick that I'm looking at versus the replacement. And if it's close, I'm looking elsewhere. I don't want to make a pick just because, you know, it's the next most valuable, because that really isn't nearly as important as what is this player's value over the next, you know, tier of guys at that position. That's going to be much more helpful than just like what is his personal, you know, projected value.
Yeah. It's funny that you brought up that Makar pick, because I did obviously a similar kind of analysis on the settings, came to the conclusion. I don't remember exactly where I had Makar on my board, but I think he was probably third or fourth. I think I had him behind McDavid and Draisaitl, and I think I might have had him above MacKinnon and Matthews. I was picking at eighth and you were at sixth, and I was in talks with the, I couldn't get ahead of you. I was positive that you were on this and that you were going to take Makar. I knew it was happening, so I couldn't get ahead of you. And then I was talking to the seventh pick team, and I was like, you know, if for whatever reason my guy gets past Victor, then I'll make a deal just to move up the one spot, because yeah, in that league, Makar's value above replacement is pretty fantastic. It's interesting that you brought up the kind of emphasis you might place on wingers over centers. In that league, I kind of did something similar. I kind of loaded up a little bit on centers. I took Pasternak in the first round. I got some guys like Philip Forsberg and Kevin Fiala. Took those guys a little bit earlier, and then kind of waited, and I ended up with Nazem Kadri, Chandler Stephenson as my top centers. And that's like, obviously to this point, that's worked out pretty fantastically. So I am definitely on board with what you're saying there about not forcing centers, I guess, if there's an equivalent winger, kind of just leaning that direction, I guess you could say, not as a like jump a tier of players to take a winger over a center, but if all other things are kind of more or less equal, you might want to lean towards those wingers just because the center value is usually pretty solid later on.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there are definitely times where I would say I would jump a tier to take a winger, right? I mean, someone like you know, Timo Meier or William Nylander, you know, someone like that, as opposed to, Elias Pettersson, but obviously that looks like a smart comment right now, but at the beginning of the season, maybe that, was more controversial, right? Or a John Tavares, type of player. I think that generally those wingers can be more valuable, because the difference between those two and, you know, the next winger that you can get versus the next center you can get is just it's a very different conversation. Right. And also kind of brings up the point of, in those types of leagues, dual eligibility is huge. Just especially at the top, right? Not necessarily, I mean, it's cool and all if you have, you know, a guy like Barclay Goodrow who can play all three positions, you can slot him in anywhere as a streamer, that's fine, but that's not the same as like Leon Draisaitl, who can slot in at left wing and center, and he's an elite player. I mean, that is really the difference between, in many cases, him and, you know, McDavid or MacKinnon. I mean, we can argue about those guys being better, and maybe they are better players, and certainly McDavid is on another level. But, you know, there's an argument to be made in terms of, like, positional flexibility there that can be pretty darn helpful when you're trying to, if you have kind of constraints and not the deepest of rosters, to be able to slide them into any position. That's a real huge benefit.
Yeah. Yeah, because those guys, like, they're going to be in your lineup. Like Pasternak, for me, for example, as my first round pick, he's right wing only, which does limit me in terms of where I can put him in my lineup. I have three right wing slots. He's got to go on one of them, and that limits who else I can fit into those remaining two slots. Whereas, like you're saying, if I have Dreisaitl and he's center left wing, now I've got six spots I can put him into, and I can kind of build around him from there, whatever I think is best on any given night. I'm curious, talking about these kind of minors picks versus veteran picks in these startup drafts, do you find, like, you've obviously been in a lot more startup drafts than I have at this point, do you find people often over or undervalue the minors picks? What's been your experience there, or has it been more or less equal?
I think the sharp players realize that especially if you're trying to win now, it's much more valuable to have the pro picks, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that most people who are in that mindset either overvalue or appropriately value, however you want to think about it, those pro picks, because obviously that the value of a mid-range guy is going to be tremendously more valuable than, you know, even a first, second, or third round prospect pick that probably isn't going to help you as much, unless you're talking about the very top and you can get someone who's going to step in and help, like, pretty immediately, like, not too many from this past draft, but like Owen Power, Matty Beniers is going to step in pretty soon and help their teams. But in general, I think that the pro picks are much more valuable unless you're talking about at the very, very top. So, like when I did that, I traded, I think it was like third and fourth and fifth round picks for first rounders. And it was like 6, 12, and 15th overall or something like that. So in those ranges, you're still getting pretty decent value. And I think that, I think Lucas Raymond was like my 15th overall pick. So you're still getting like,
sure.
You know, obviously that looks a lot smarter now. That was 2 years ago. But things like in general, those, like, that value is not going to be as high as someone that you can get as a fourth rounder who, you know, where you're talking about basically guys that are forwards that are probably going to be in the top, you know, 50 to 100 and defensemen in the top 30 to 40. So that's pretty hard to replace because most of those prospect picks are not going to be at that level, right? Let's just be honest about that. So in general, I think that most players appropriately value those pro picks, but it is like you will find every once in a while those people that overvalue the minor picks, and you know, I think that's an opportunity. If someone really does value those highly, you might be able to take advantage of that situation.
Yeah, I think there's definitely something to be said for just kind of canvassing the landscape when you're in a startup. If you have those two drafts, the veteran in the minors drafts, and just kind of saying, you know, hi, this is my name. What do you think about this valuation of veteran versus minors drafts? Like whatever you think that valuation might be, just put it in a ballpark for them. And sometimes you'll get people who come back with a really strong opinion on what they think the valuation is, and it might be very different from what you think the valuation of a pro versus a minors pick should be. And sometimes you can find deals that way where you end up with something that you think, and if you've done your research well, you're confident in, is really valuable for your team. One more question about the startup draft itself. Now, as you're progressing through the draft, maybe it comes up on another left winger. You've kind of mostly felt like you've gotten yourself set at wing and you wanted to transition into some centers, but there's that left winger staring at you who's in that kind of tier by himself left on your board. Are you trying to balance your roster as you build it? Are you just going to grab that value just because he's in, you see him kind of in a little bit of a different tier than the center who's behind him? What would be your strategy if kind of presented with that situation?
I would take that player. I generally don't try to fill out my roster with positional needs until at least the middle, but more likely towards the end of the draft. I'm still really looking at value over replacement at that point, especially if you're talking about wingers and D. I feel like those are always harder to come by, unless you're talking about elite centers like Barkov, you know, things like that. Matthews, you know, McKinnon, McDavid. Those guys, obviously a different discussion, but in general, you're, even if you have like, you know, three, like too many left wings that you can fit in your lineup on any given day, you're going to be able to get a king's ransom for that player. Mm-hmm. Taking them, because odds are, if you're looking at that player and you're seeing the value of a replacement at that position, the person behind you, or two or three or five spots, is just salivating that they're still there. So right. If you take them, you will have leverage, you know, to find an appropriate buyer. If you do want to trade him, and of course, if you have a skater spot or multiple skater spots, then that opens up, you know, your yep. flexibility, and you can still fit him in. And then you can always, it's much easier at the end of your draft to add a player at a certain position that is at least above replacement, or, you know, or something along those lines of serviceable, right? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes you can hit on a, you know, someone that you thought maybe had some upside, and they realize that potential, and then you're doing great at yeah. that position. But I wouldn't pass if I had that opportunity to add a player, even if I felt like I was good at that position. And this has happened to me a couple times where I've taken, like you mentioned, Pasternak, taking right wingers. I think there was one draft where I had Kane. And then I'm trying to remember who else I had. I had two of like the top right wingers. I was thinking it was Pasternak and Kane. That seems that seems impossible. But I had a couple of really top wingers. And then there was another. Yeah, and then there was another right winger that was still sitting there at like the third round. And I was like, I don't know. I just feel like I got to do it, you know, because mm-hmm. there was so much value there. So even if you're like, I really feel like I should get a center or a D, If there is truly a player that's slipping that is much more valuable in your estimation than where he should be, I think you're going to do it. I guess some people would worry like, well, what if I take him and then no one wants to trade him? Well, either you made a mistake in your evaluation of that player, because if he really wasn't worth that much, then maybe you made a mistake. But if he really is, then someone's going to want in on that player, and you're mm-hmm. going to be able to move him for probably more than you could have got. Now, generally, that's not going to happen right after the draft. You know, you might have right. to wait a little bit, and you have to weather that storm a little bit, because, you know, the closer you are to the draft, people just base their opinions on the draft. But as you get, you know, further along, and now we're, you know, many weeks into the season, so at this point, people are, you know, whether it's dynasty or redraft, people are not necessarily relying on draft position to, you know, make yeah. their decisions. And so it's a little bit easier as you get farther and farther away. And of course the standings, you know, help with that as well. If you can trade with the team who needs the help, it's a lot easier. You have more leverage.
Yeah. Yeah. So speaking of that, Victor, you and I have been tossing around a little bit of a trade idea. You've been interested in Pasternak as one of the top teams in this league. I kind of opted for a younger route. I did trade some of my pro picks for some rookie picks. I felt I got a value that I couldn't really pass up when talking to some league mates before the draft. So I made some trades. I ended up with a lot of rookie studs that I'm pretty excited about. Trevor Zegras, Lucas Raymond, Bowen Byram, Connor McMichael, Cole Caulfield, guys like that. But obviously, having traded away some of my pro picks, my team isn't quite at the top of the league. I think I'm 3-3 right now, so I'm not at the bottom, but not at the top. And I'm entertaining the idea of moving Pasternak to kind of add to my super young core here. So we've been talking about Well, first you came to me and said, what's the price on Pastrnak? Just kind of knocking on doors. And so I took a look at your team, and you do have Oliver Wahlstrom, who is one of my guys who I've been banging the table for since like June this offseason, when I got a good look at his advanced stats from his rookie year. Now, obviously, Wahlstrom hasn't had a great year. It seems like he's kind of been in the doghouse a bit with Barry Trotz there in New York. But I do still believe in the talent. So that's a nice piece for me. We've talked about including Marco Rossi, who's a nice piece. I'm pretty bullish on his potential for the league. And then a first-round pick. So Rossi, Wahlstrom, and a first-round pick for Pastrnak. Now, we're not going to settle this on the air here, but I am going to, for those people who are listening to this on Spotify, I am going to include a poll. And I'm curious if people think that Wahlstrom, Rossi, and a first-round pick in an 18-team league. So Victor will probably be, it looks like, I think you're undefeated right now, Victor, or close to it, that you'll be towards the top end. So kind of a later first round pick, but still valuable, obviously. I'm going to put a poll in for the people listening on Spotify if they think that's enough for Pastrnak, and we'll see what the people say after this, but it's definitely something we're tossing around, and I haven't quite made up my mind. It's a point I wanted to bring up actually in this discussion too, is it's really hard to find elite producers like Pastrnak. You can argue that Rossi has that ceiling. I think he potentially does, but there's a lot of people who potentially have that ceiling and not so many who actually ever hit that ceiling. I'm curious on your thoughts here, Victor. Are you of the same mindset as me that it's really valuable to try to accumulate some of these elite guys, kind of let them carry your squad, build around them, kind of fill in with, obviously, depending on the size of your league, there might be some waiver wire guys. Otherwise, you might be able to make some kind of lower tier trades just to kind of fill out with those steady but not exciting lower points per game producers. Kind of curious on your thoughts on elite players. I know we talked a little bit about the middle of your lineup in some leagues being really valuable too. So just curious what your thoughts are, especially for this league as a contending team right at the top of the standings right now.
Yeah, well, I think this is what makes Dynasty League so fun, is that we can both win this trade, or like two people could clearly get what they want, win the trade, be happy. And this is kind of what I would say too, like you're in this position where you're kind of in the middle. Your team is probably not good enough to win right now. I mean, there are four teams in this league that are 6-0. We haven't played each other, and we won't for like 3 or 4 more weeks. So we could conceivably have like 4 10-0 teams, and you know, the rest of the teams are like, one of us is probably going to win. I'm not saying it's going to be me, but one of these top teams is clearly good. Actually, the two teams that are ahead of me by points for are better, I would say, than my team. And so this is what I really think it makes sense for someone in your position to look at this and say, okay, like, let's be realistic. My team is overperforming. Frankly, it's probably better for a team like you to sell off a high-end asset. Not that you have to do that to me, but get a really good return. Your team will be a little worse. You get a better draft pick. And in 2 or 3 years, or maybe next year, possibly even, you'll be much, much, much better. So I think that makes sense. Not that you necessarily have to sell the top guys, but I'm generally of the opinion, like when I want to make a trade like this, I usually go to the top of the roster. I don't go to the bottom of the roster. I look at who the best players are, and I offer my best players. You know, I think it's insulting if I went to you and said, oh, David Pastrnak, cool. How about Luke Glendening for him? Like, that's absurd, right? And insulting, and you would tell me to take a hike. So I came at you and said, yeah, you know, Rossi's on the table. Like, I'll include some of my best prospects. I know you like Wahlstrom. So, you know, obviously he's underperforming, but the talent's there. I think it's one of those situations where we could both really benefit, or teams like us could really benefit. A team at the top who has some nice assets that are going to help them later, like Rossi and Wahlstrom are not going to help them right now.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's possible that Rossi gets called up and contributes a little bit this year, but he's probably not going to be that valuable for another year or two, maybe. And Wahlstrom, I mean, all of Long Island is broken right now. So
yeah.
You know, that's not going to probably help too much. And the pick is, you know, whatever, like Magic teams, right? So I think one of those situations where, yeah, this is exactly why Dynasty is so fun, because you can take a team at the bottom, a team at the top, and you can really, you know, help each one. Obviously, teams at the top, that if you do this too much, you run into the problem where you don't have any assets left and your time at the top is sort of limited, and then you can sort of crash and burn. So I feel like this is where, you know, listening to podcasts like ours, you can find some diamonds in the rough. You can find some later round prospects that, you know, work out. And that's generally my strategy, is like, okay, I feel like I can find some of these prospects that maybe some others might overlook. Of course, when you talk about it on the podcast, it doesn't work so well, but you know, you can find some of these second or third rounders that might end up being pretty good contributors. And then you don't have to just rely on the first round picks to, you know, have the best prospects. So I feel like a trade like that is pretty fair. I mean, I know that not everyone is as high on Marco Rossi, but I think he's going to be an elite, you know, star in this league, and will be pretty valuable. I think, you know, obviously the jury's still out on Wahlstrom. He's shown signs. So, but hard to argue with the production that Pasternak has given. And I think we should also say that he is 27th in points per game for skaters in this league.
Right.
So he is, he's not a top 10 pick, as some might think. Of course, he's slightly underperformed, I guess you might say.
Yeah.
But he's easily a top 30, and possibly, if things shift a little bit, top, you know, 20 player. So he's clearly valuable, and especially at his position, if you just sort by right wings, which I have right here, let's see what he is in terms of just his right wing rank. I imagine he's all the way up there.
He's got to be up there.
Well, actually, Timo Meier, who you also have, is of course also like, is there the top 10. But I think I'd be foolish to target Meier over Pasternak just based on what he's doing right now and how maybe slightly unsustainable it is. So Pasternak is currently the fifth ranked right wing behind Meier, Kucherov, Rantanen, and Elias Lindholm. So he's definitely up there. And then there's, you know, there's a bit of a drop between him and the Nylanders and even Patrick Kane and, of course, the Hall of Famer Troy Terry.
Yes. That kind of leads me into my next question. How do you identify, like, we've talked a little bit here and there about, you know, this guy might be overperforming, this guy might be underperforming. How do you identify when you want to make a move? And maybe this varies kind of depending on where your team is. As a contender, you might be a little more willing to ride with a guy you think is overperforming, just because you're kind of all in on that season anyway. I'm not sure, but I'm curious what would be your process? How do you look at these players and say, I think I want to be out of the Meyer business, or out of the Philip Forsberg business after a 4-goal game, whatever the case may be, right? How do you come to that conclusion? And then conversely, how do you identify guys that you want to target?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are some very clear, simple things to look at. Shooting percentage for goal scorers is probably the easiest thing.
Right.
If they have a career norm and they're shooting well above that, you have to imagine that's going to regress. And Troy Terry was a classic example. He was like at 30% or something. And everybody kept saying, well, he keeps scoring. And I kept saying, it's going to stop. It's going to stop. And you know, of course, he kept doing it for a while. But, you know, that kind of thing is not going to sustain. It's just impossible. You can, the streak can go on for a while, but it's not going to continue. So that's a big one. You also want to look at points participation, if the IPP, if that's really high. and you have to kind of know what the average for forward and D are. I mean, generally good defensemen are like at 50 and good forwards are like at 70. There's some variation there, but if somebody's, 90% IPP and, they're getting on more points than they should. So that's another good one. And then PDO, which is kind of a luck metric of combination of shooting percentage and save percentage for when they're on the ice. So that should be around 1,000, or some people use 100, I guess, but 1,000. And you want that to be right around there. So those are the big ones, but I think it's more nuanced than that because you have to look at like role deployment. You know, someone like Timo Meier is a good example actually, because he's someone that, you know, a lot of us have been high on. We've looked at rate stats that indicate he's a volume shooter, and he just needed more time on ice and he needed more opportunity. And for a long time, he was not getting a lot of power play time. This season, he's getting the most power play time of his career. He's getting the most time on ice of his career. So you look at that and say, okay, I mean, that kind of makes sense. He's a high pedigree guy who has had good underlying numbers. And when we say that, usually we mean rate stats. So per 60 have been good. Just wasn't getting that much time on ice. I mean, he was getting like, 16 minutes, 17 sometimes. And, it's hard to translate that without the right opportunity, especially power play time, which has been minimal in recent years. So if the role changes, they get more time on ice, more power play, better deployment with, good centers. You have to be careful with deployment though, because of course that can change. But, someone like Meyer, who's been consistently with Couture, arguably the Sharks, best player, one of their best players, that matters, right? Whereas someone like Trey Terry, who's like kind of doing this on his own with smoke and mirrors, and I would argue not elite talent on the Anaheim Ducks, that's just a lot of noise, and there's so many luck metrics for Trey Terry that are off the charts that you just know are going to regress. So I think you have to look at that. You have to look at context. You know it's really difficult with young players because you don't have career averages. So you kind of have to go based on pedigree, historical norms, what we kind of know of the player. A lot of times with young players, they're getting a ton of secondary assists, or they're just the benefactor third wheel on a good line, or maybe, they're like Trey Terry, they're just shooting. They're just getting really lucky with too many shots going in. So those are all things that you kind of have to look at. And I think it's even harder for defensemen because defensemen just don't score as much. So there's a lot more variance there. And in general, there really aren't many defensemen who are that valuable, that are consistently good point producers. This is why we were talking about Makar, and I'm in another league with our buddy Cam Robinson, who a lot of people know. And I got Makar in that league. And of course, everybody's coming after Makar constantly. That's great offers, and it's like, no. I mean, unless you're offering me your firstborn, I'm not going to trade Makar, because everybody knows, I know, they all know, the value over all the other D, even the other good D, in that league. Like an example is Victor Hedman, right? So Victor Hedman certainly has potential to put up points, but it's not. He's not always as consistently elite. I mean, he has obviously a lot of the tools at his disposal. And there have been other defensemen that have kind of waxed and waned. You look at Eric Carlson, you look at Yossi, and they have a lot of variance season to season. John Carlson, who was like, amazing that one season, and he's like still good, but like it's not the same season to season. There's just a lot of variance. And so particularly in that situation, do not trade your Cale Makar as your younger elite defenseman, right? Because that's the other thing, is when they're younger, they have more room to grow. Whereas like Hedman, I mean, he is what he is, and he's good, but how many of those elite years does he have left, compared to Makar? Not as many. So in a dynasty league, that is definitely a no-go. There's someone like Quinn Hughes in a points heavy league is another example of someone that I would be very hesitant to move, just because it's really hard to find that similar situation. So there's a lot to looking at that, but basically, you look under the hood, you look at the shooting percentage, the points participation, the PDO, those are the best ones. And then other little things like offensive zone starts are the ones to look at. Quality of competition for and against is something that is good to look at. It doesn't necessarily sway me too much, but if they're only getting deployed against the worst competition, a couple things can happen. One, that can change and the coach can start trusting them more and putting out there more situations and their deployment's going to go down. Or they stay in that sort of specialist role, which means their time on ice goes down and also their scoring might go down. So those are things that you have to kind of worry about. The best players and the most valuable fantasy players are generally the ones that are out there regardless of who's defending them, and they still put up points, and that's what you want. And those are, you don't even really need to look that up. Those are all the players that you know are amazing. But when you see someone doing it without with the easiest quality of competition, that can be a bit of a red flag.
Sure. Yeah, good stuff there. I want to dig in just for a second into the prospect side of this. Obviously, this is a big portion of Dynasty, finding the next wave of stars for the league and how to navigate those waters. There's plenty of scouts you can follow on Twitter. There's plenty of draft guides that come out from various sources. I'm curious, Victor, what your kind of go-to guides or sources might be for prospects specifically.
Yeah, so many. I mean, I kind of, Jesse and I consider ourselves kind of compilers of all that information. I mean, definitely not a primary scout, although I do watch way too much hockey, including junior and foreign hockey. Mm-hmm. But I really trust the opinions, particularly of elite prospects. EQ Ringside is one of my go-tos. I really like their breakdowns, their opinions. They have some really smart people over there. They're probably my biggest go-to, but that's for general hockey. So that's more for like who's going to be an impact NHL or not necessarily fantasy. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Double Prospects is great. Sometimes I think you got to be really careful with the upside comparables, though. The one that still makes me laugh to this day is a player that I know well, Sasha Shemilevsky, who's a Sharks prospect.
Yeah,
and I remember Dauber saying his upside comparable was David Pastrnak.
Oh, wow.
I, of course, would love that if that were the case as a Sharks fan. But I don't really understand how that's even a good comparable, because they're not even like similar types of players.
Right.
Our Shemilevsky's shot is nowhere near where Pastrnak is. He's not, I mean, he has good hockey IQ, which Pastrnak does too, but they're just very, very, very different players. And I don't see the upside remotely near that. Of course, it's easy to poke holes and, one missed thing. I generally love Dauber and think they're great. So I'm not trying to disparage them, but you have to be careful. Sometimes you read those upside and you're like, ooh, you know, it gets super
excited. Yeah.
And that's why it's upside. Most likely it's not going to happen, but if it did, that would be the comparable. I also really like hockey prospecting model that Byron Bader runs, you know, which is a NHL equivalency data model, which is really, really good. And I think you also have to be careful with that because, you know, a lot of those equivalencies with small sample sizes can look great and then it doesn't work out, especially when roles change, ice time changes, all that kind of stuff. And someone can look amazing in one season and then with a bigger role, more ice time, more quality competition, it goes down. So going up in levels does not mean that you're going to have greater success. But I think one of the things that model really points out well is that if you're playing in, you know, Canadian major junior league, that is not anywhere near the same as playing in the SHL or in the Czech Extraliga or in the Finnish or the KHL. And it's really hard to look at some of those players that aren't putting up a ton of points. I mean, William Eklund is a classic example from last year's draft, who put up half point a game in the SHL in his draft season, which you look at and say, yeah, you know, there's guys in the, you know, WHL putting up almost 2 points a game like Dylan Gunther. Mm-hmm. And those two are very interesting to compare because they're different players, and Gunther is a fantastic player, I think. But if I had to choose between the two, I'm taking Eklund every day of the week because he's playing against much more difficult competition and excelling at a very young age and the smarts that you have to have. So I think, you know, that the data-driven is really important, but I think it's also really important to blend the two. I mean, the eye test is not everything, but it's really important to trust the opinions of scouts who are looking at these players, but it's also important to look at the numbers and see what they say and kind of try to blend the two, which is what we try to do on the podcast. So those are really good ones. And the other one that I really like is Fantalytica, mm-hmm. which uses an algorithm to basically look at the production of a player and see what their first full season in the NHL might look like from a fantasy perspective. And that's what's really great about Fantalytica is that they, mm-hmm. you can actually input your custom settings. It really works well for points leagues, and they have access to proprietary data like hits and blocks and stuff like that that you might have in your league. So you can kind of plug that in and say, okay, which of these players is projected to have the most success in their first season. And if you're doing your rookie draft, you can basically just rank based on that and come out with some really good players that other people probably aren't even looking at. Or you can go plug it in right now and see, wow, this player is available in my league and he's supposed to have a pretty big impact right away. And you can get some real gems in that. So those are some ones that I really, really like. I think I look at other guides too every now and then. I think Elite Prospects and Dauber are the two main ones I go for the write-ups, and then Fanalytica and Hockey Prospecting for the sort of more data-driven approach.
Yeah. Yeah, I would echo those for myself. I've used all four of those sources. Definitely recommend them as well. I have to give a shout-out to Fanalytica and Hockey Prospecting for putting me onto Sasha Pastujov. Snagged him in a draft this year, I think 22nd overall. And so far he's been absolutely lighting it up in Guelph in my town here where I live. So that's been fun to track. So definitely recommend those sources as well. All right, Victor. Well, it's been an hour of this and it's been great. I wish we had more time. I could go on like this for hours. I'm sure you could too. But why don't you just go ahead and tell the people where they can follow all the great content you're producing and catch up with you.
Yeah, so you can check us out at the Fantasy Hockey Life podcast. If you can listen to that on any podcast aggregator of your choice, Apple Podcasts, it'd be great if you left us a review. That helps us out, helps the podcast. And you can follow me at Victor Nuno 12 on Twitter, VictorNuno12. And I pretty much only tweet about hockey stuff. So I don't tweet about other stuff. So if you're like, oh, I don't want to follow someone that's going to give me all their political opinions, I don't do that. I also write for the Sharks and about prospects at the Hockey Writers. So mm-hmm. you can check out my stuff there. And I think that's it. So. Yeah, thanks for having me on. It was a blast. And definitely, if you haven't tried Dynasty Leagues, don't be intimidated by the prospects. I think a lot of people will kind of treat it as a redraft league and just have prospects that help them, you know, now. And there's nothing wrong with that. And you can kind of learn as you go. There are definitely some of us, I'm sure you've seen this in your leagues, Nate, where people get too enamored with their prospects and just want to have all the best young players and never actually compete. And so... you don't want to be on that end of the spectrum either. You got to kind of find a happy balance and it's super fun. It's super fun to see these players come of age and finally, you know, rocking on your team and helping you win championships. I find that more gratifying than the redraft league wins where, you know, you put in the work for a season, but when you put in the work for years and you get the championship, like there's nothing quite like that feeling.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, Dynasty is so much fun. It's a whole nother level of fantasy hockey. And I love redraft and Dynasty both, but it's definitely just a whole nother animal. Lots and lots of fun to be had. If anyone listening to this is not also listening to the Fantasy Hockey Life podcast, you need to change that situation right now. It's a go-to for me with regards to Dynasty and prospects in particular. I'll make sure I link it up in the show description. Yeah, Victor, I had so much fun tonight. Thank you for joining me on the show and dropping some knowledge for the listeners.
Thanks so much, Nate. It was a blast.
All right, folks, that's all I've got for this episode. Hopefully it brought you some value, helped you get a little bit better at fantasy hockey today. I'd be pumped if you were to take 30 seconds, throw a quick review rating on the podcast. Would mean a lot to me and help get this podcast into more ear holes. Make sure you find your way into the Apples and Genos and the Fantasy Hockey Life Discord communities. Great way to meet people with a common interest, get instant fantasy advice from hundreds of other knowledgeable fantasy managers, including Victor and myself. That's it, folks. Much love.